Welcome to season 4 of the Intersection Hub podcast. This season, we are changing the conversation. We are going to go beyond talking about the challenges the charitable sector faces and start spotlighting charities who are offering us hope, hope for a new way forward in 3 primary areas. That's right. In this season, we are sharing 8 real examples of organizations who are advancing anti-racist work, moving forward with trust-based philanthropy, and taking care of the physical and mental well-being of their staff. So thank you for sharing a little bit of your day with us. Let's get to it. If you were the CEO of a for-profit company and 48% of your sales team had one foot out the door and were scanning the horizon for a better job, would you make a correction? Of course you would. And yet, for decades, the charitable sector has been tolerating a revolving door of staff with the average tenure for senior-level fundraisers at just 18 months. That is hardly enough time to figure out how the coffee maker works, let alone build strong relationships with donors. And yet we seem content to hemorrhage human and financial resources. It's time for a change. And today on this episode, we are going to give you an example of how it should work. Today on our podcast, we are spotlighting the British Columbia Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And under the leadership of powerhouse fundraiser Shoni Field, the BCSBCA is a great example of an organization that prioritizes building a loyal team. Shoni is going to share more about the work of the BCSBCA, so I'll tell you a little bit about her. Shoni is the Chief Development Officer and is very proud of her skilled and passionate team of innovators who consistently exceed industry benchmarks. She has been fundraising for just over 25 years for a range of causes, including environmental, youth, health, and development organizations. Shoni is the founder of the Four Paws Summit for Animal Welfare Fundraisers, and when she's not fundraising, she advocates for electoral reform and citizen engagement, plays strategy games, and bakes fancy cakes. Ooh, that sounds good. I love cake. Shoni is a settler on the unceded traditional territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. In this episode, Shoni and I cover a lot of territory. We talk about rethinking performance metrics, what makes a good boss, values-based decision-making, and creating psychological safety for your team. Shoni is fun to hang out with, talk to, and learn from, so I think you will really enjoy this one. Let's get into it. Shoni, I am so, so happy to welcome you into the Hub today. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Mm-hmm. I've had such fun conversations with you that I thought this is going to be fun.
You know, when we met each other at AFP Congress in real life, and you were sitting with a group of people that I know extremely well, but I didn't know you. And they said, oh, you don't know Shoni. So you have quite a reputation out here in Ontario. Did you know that?
I did not know that. I always feel like I know far less people in the fundraising sector than everyone else. But I think it's just there's so many of us that we all know our circle. And then we're surprised where the circles don't perfectly align, that there's which is delightful that there's new people, that I can have been doing this for more than 20 years and still like meet new people that I'm excited to meet.
Well, I certainly enjoyed meeting you. So let's get into this, okay? Before we get started talking about the BCSBCA, tell me a little bit about something. I've already read your bio to everybody and we pre-recorded that, but tell me what people may not know about you.
Oh, what do people not know about me?
Yeah. This season I'm throwing people... right off the bridge at the very beginning. What is it that people are surprised to know?
The thing that I think I learned a ton from as a younger adult that I know I bring a lot into my fundraising work, but seems like not related to it is in 2004, I was fortunate enough to be randomly selected to be a part of the Citizens Assembly in British Columbia, studying electoral reform and making a recommendation to change the voting system. And that was a really pivotal year in my life of getting me engaged in my community again, where I'd grown up in a very engaged in the community household and felt like I'd fallen into this trough of not being able to figure out my way to do that as a young adult. And so I got to spend this year with 160 Wren or 159 plus me randomly selected people from across British Columbia, looking at like what made BC unique and how we work together and how we wanted politics to happen and the types of conversations and thoughtful decision making we wanted to have. And so much from that year comes back to me when I'm working with a group of people and wanting to get to the point of a decision or are moving forward. And so it was a really pivotal year for me and got me back involved and engaged in things.
Wow. Were your kids born then? Were you a mother already?
So my youngest was 6 months old when I started this year. We were at the WASC Center in downtown Vancouver, which is this beautiful center for dialogue in a circle. And I've got this picture of him sitting on the desk as a baby at one of the evening sessions. So Every second weekend over the course of a year, we would pack up and move downtown for the weekend. And my husband would take my oldest to like swim lessons and they'd go for long walks. And I would talk thoughtfully about democracy.
Wow. And advancing civic engagement. That's incredible. So what comes to mind for me, and we're going to get into our topic for the day in a second, but what comes to mind for me for that is just how did that experience shape and influence your role as a leader in the charitable sector?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a couple of things that I keep coming back to. One is the first day, the chair of the assembly, Jack Blaney, wonderful leader, said, we're going to do this without Robert's Rules of Order. I don't want to put a lot of structure around this. We're going to have a thoughtful, respectful, this is what I remember many years later, thoughtful, respectful conversation. We're going to disagree at times. We're going to agree that nothing's decided till everything's decided. And we're going to work through this together. And it was just such a good setting the stage for it. And then the sort of process we went through was we broke everything down into these really small decisions. And so rather than getting overwhelmed of, how could we possibly get there from here? It was broken down into these really small decisions that all seemed very easy and intuitive at the time. And they built up over time. So for us, it was really clear that we had a core set of values as a group that transcended our age, our rural, urban, our political inclinations, our life's experience. And once we used those core values to go through a decision-making process, you know, it really felt very comfortable. And so I think back to that a lot of how to take something apart to make small, easy decisions and arrive at a place where you have a sort of clear set of values to guide you towards a big final decision.
And it sounds like a couple of things that I love about that is that your facilitator really set a framework for what the ground rules of the discussion are. And he also, even though you were all there to do something quite big and intangible, he broke it down into bite-sized pieces for you all just to tackle together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't get me started on the shared values. I talk about that a lot. So I noticed as I was preparing for this conversation, that you have been at the SPCA in British Columbia for over 9 years.
Actually I was, and they were one of my clients when I was doing consulting too. So it's, so I've been working with them since 2010. So it's a long time.
So that's 13 years that you've been working with that organization. What do you think the magic is around your loyalty?
It, This actually comes up a fair bit because when I'm interviewing someone, when people are thoughtful about the interview, they'll often ask me, "What is it that makes you stay? What do you like about it?" It's a question I really love from people. And I think there's a couple of things. One is I've always, and when I first started, I wasn't part of the leadership team, but I've always really respected the leadership team for the combination of professional skills and commitment to the mission that they have. And it's common to work with people that have one or the other great professional skill set, but sort of may barrel straight through, or people that love the mission and got there because they were really passionate about it and sort of, evolved over time into a role and then just don't necessarily have the skills they need to take something to the next level. And I really love that everyone was sort of had a huge amount of expertise in their field and could work towards sort of being best in class in their field. And so that felt like a really good place that you could look around you and say, "I really like how finance is run. I really like how people services is run. I respect the decision-making process and the expertise there." The second thing was that I came into a really positive work environment. And in my time, I think as all fundraisers who've been a while and at it a while, have been in environments that are toxic and competitive and don't bring the best out in people. And so I had a leader who gave me a huge amount of leeway, was really interested in learning from what I could bring to the table and really great at coaching me and cared about me as a person. And I would every meeting would start with a like, "No, but how are you?" and a
Yeah,
check-in.
like
And
for
I,
really, like really
yes,
hard.
really. Yeah. And so that was the second thing. And the third thing was it I discovered my sweet spot in fundraising is sort of being able to iterate and optimize. And it was a large enough organization that we could afford to take some risks. And I love being able to take some risks. And sometimes that means you fail and you get it wrong and you learn a whole pile. But it was really nice not to be to have that luxury of not being in the space where every single dollar counted and you couldn't risk anything. And so therefore it becomes really hard to move ahead and innovate when everything's on the line for every decision you make.
And just, I mean, one of those things there, I want to give you an opportunity to clarify. Every single dollar does count at the
Yes.
SPCA. However, you have a file that's large enough that you are able to weigh the return on investment with the risk
Yeah.
involved, right?
I think we know, and this sort of gets into something that's really core for our team, is we know that some things will have a stellar year and totally blow past goals, and some things there'll be some struggles with them. And so it's a large enough file that we don't have that
Play.
we can play a little with it. And our favorite years are when we all blow past our goals, and
Yeah,
that
of
feels
course.
like, gravy for all of us, but it doesn't always happen, but we can cover each other. It's not like and we're very clear that the what our goal is the bottom line and not individual people's portfolios. You're not going to be fired or get a negative performance review based on your individual portfolio, because sometimes your portfolio needs to take a riskier or like a building for the future. Like, we're going to do this thing that's going to cost us this year, but 5 years down the road, we're going to be so much more secure because we've taken our time with an individual donor and built up a stronger relationship and not pushed for like the short return. And I guess that is what I mean of like, we could, it's not that every dollar doesn't count, but we could afford to be in it for the long game, where it's better for the organization to be in it for the long game.
Okay. So I want to talk I really want to talk about those team-based performance metrics, because I have often thought that if we could measure the success of a major gift officer off of the success of the annual fund officer, then that would be like the mecca of fundraising. And so while I'm going to be a little bit disciplined about geeking out over fundraising, because that's been my default and that's your default, but I really want to focus on, and we're going to get to that, team-based performance metrics. But do you call it that? You should call it that. That should be a thing. We should call it that.
It's interesting because and not all of our team-based metrics are dollar-based. And yeah. So
not all dollar-based. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's the even more important thing, because as I've thought about this, it feels like there's a sort of progression of maturity and a sort of young, and I don't, not in age, but a developing, let's call it a developing shop. It's all money-based.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can get to the point where maybe within teams, you can have money and some other key performance indicators. Mm-hmm. And then it feels like the third stage of evolution is to see, let's say, like, we're actually going to have some shared key performance indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And we have two of them that we can both, we can all agree on as an entire team that we're striving towards. And they're about long-term health of the organization. And sometimes they mean making a decision that doesn't produce the most money in the short term. For us, they're new donor performance and long-time value. And we know where every team member, what their area of prominence it is. It's not like they only contribute to one, but there's some that are predisposed, sort of lean 80-20 towards one or 70-30 towards the other. And so we know what the roles are and how we're all building that greater long-term sustainability.
Okay. I love so much of what you just said. Your performance is not based solely on revenue metrics, that you have lots of room to innovate within your organization. You've talked about having a learning culture and looking ahead for the long game, long-term sustainability, so that you can take risks in the short term. You can innovate, you can tweak, and you can be in it for the long haul. And I'm curious about whether or not that results in longer staff retention.
Yeah, our retention's always thrown off a bit because we have people that have been there for 15, 17 years. So it makes us look really great.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look around, as we've built up, you know, when I came in, we had that positive culture and we hadn't yet built up that culture around shared non-monetary goals.
Mm-hmm.
And our turnover has decreased over, there's a couple of other things, but as we have that long term, we're building towards something. We're not starting over again every single year with an empty bucket that we have to fill that feels like we're pushing a boulder up a hill. It does give people a reason to invest in long term.
Mm-hmm. And to think long term about overcoming some of these pitfalls so that they can be part of the wins a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you might not know this, Shoni, but someone who works for you actually worked for me in 2008. And we had a chance to chat last fall, and she raved about how much she loved working there.
I love hearing that it's easy for the boss to say it's a happy place.
That's right.
I love it when people are like, I'm really happy here.
I want to be very clear that she's been with you for over 4 years. She has no plans to go anywhere. She loves working there, and she couldn't say enough nice things about you. So, and I don't want to embarrass her by calling out her name, but I do want to ask you what you think makes you such a good boss. And I'm going to give you permission, because when I approached you about this podcast, let's be honest, you said, are you talking about me? I never really thought of myself that way. So I want to, give you permission to think of yourself that way. And
I think a lot about how I'm developing the fundraising program. But then over time, as I look at it, I've gotten more confident in my role as a leader and say, see, okay, there's some things that keep reoccurring that are really important.
Yeah.
We talked about the shared goals and the long term. And the thing I really like about that is it gives a roadmap. And we've agreed where we're getting to, but we haven't agreed the route we're taking. Mm. And so that means no one needs to micromanage, because there's room, like just as there's room for me to play with it, there's room for my colleagues on my team to play with it and find, hey, we thought 3 years ago this was going to be the path towards building up our monthly donor base or identifying more legacy expectants. And something new is emerging, and I sort of want to play with it and see where it goes. Mm-hmm. And because we've agreed on what the sort of the metrics are, mm-hmm. that is, we don't get hung up on the tactics that we're going to use to get there. And so I think that gives people a lot of autonomy, which feels good. Like that's one of our basic psychological needs, is to have some autonomy and not feel sort of out of control.
Yeah, they have agency over their job.
Yeah.
What else?
So I think so. That's really important to me. I think giving people the whys, and it's you know terrible when someone when talking about people with specialties in their field who are adults to give as an analogy an experience you have raising children, but I'm going to go there anyway.
Hey, yeah, go.
You know, I think of times in parenting, we very consciously would give our kids the background, the explanation, the why, the setting expectations. And I remember one time being two sort of three-year-olds in a room, one of them, my eldest son, and we had to go somewhere. And my son knew we were going and why we were going. The other child did not, had no explanation. The TV was turned off. Mm. Meltdown, tears, tantrum, mm-hmm. didn't understand the why and didn't have any context to put that in. And I, you know, it's an imperfect analogy, but there's sometimes when I have to make decisions that people don't like, or they wish we were, specifically, you know, when we're talking about where are we going to invest new resources, everyone's a great advocate for their area. And so I have to narrow that down and say, they're all good. And this is the most strategically important to move us forward on this roadmap. And so when I'm really clear about what the parameters are behind the decision, what the background is and what's happening organizationally, you know, when we can't share a certain story that we come across that's really compelling and we know it'll raise a lot of money, but there's a strategic reason why we can't talk about it publicly at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things help build that trust and understanding of how we're getting somewhere. And also, I hope, like, even though people are really happy where they are, they're not going to stay there forever. So if they can go on to another organization and have a sort of roadmap of how to build up sort of long-term health of a team and a fundraising structure, then, you know, that's like a great toolkit for them to have too. And when managers hold the whys really close to their chest, it doesn't allow people to be able to learn how to do that themselves and make those decisions when they're in that position, because they're all great fundraisers. So they're going to continue to grow in there and be making bigger and bigger decisions as they develop.
So the roadmap and helping people understand the why, the reason why you're making the call or headed in the direction that you're headed in. One of the things that came to mind for me while you were talking about that, and I can go into parenting analogies all day, and I hear what you're saying. You don't mean to be patronizing to your staff. There are things when you're a parent, you are learning and practicing leadership every single day. And part of that leadership is to know when to move forward and to know when to be flexible. And I don't know about you, but there is a woman named Barbara Colarosso who wrote a wonderful book, parenting book called Kids Are Worth It. And she talked about being a brick wall parent where there was complete inflexibility, and then being jellyfish parent where you can't make a decision or provide any structure.
Yeah.
And she advocated for backbone parenting. And so while you were explaining that, that's where my mind went, that there's flexibility within the structure of a backbone, but there's still structure and leadership there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the phrase I keep coming back to is this open for negotiation?
I love that.
I've got staff that use that and I love it. And if my answer is no, it always has to be accompanied by a why. Like, it's not just like the wall of no.
Right.
But I try and talk about this when I'm doing an onboarding for new staff, and new staff sit down with me for an hour or connect virtually with me for an hour, and we go through the roadmap and why we're doing what we're doing and where everything fits in. So they all have that insight right from the beginning. And the point I try to make is, here are, you know, our grounds of disagreement here are our data. So you're welcome to disagree with me. Bring me some data. Sometimes you're bringing me a little kernel of a hypothesis that
right.
you'd like to test to get the data. But, you know, I've started in direct mail and I am not my target audience, and I'm 99% wrong when I test something in direct mail, because I'm like, surely they're going to love this. It's more attractive. It's easier
right.
to read. No, in fact, we like the cramped and ugly. Thank you very much. You know, and so, you know, people can have that gut feeling, but what we say is like, okay, so let's pilot it. Let's test it. Let's, you know, see if we can back it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the framework for disagreement. And that's the sort of framework for negotiation on things of like, is this open for negotiation? Because I've observed something different and I'd like to explore that.
Shoni, I just realized that I didn't ask at the beginning to provide context for the listeners. I just assumed everybody knows what the SBCA does, but I want to give you an opportunity to just give us your brief little explanation of that and the size of your organization, just to provide people context for this conversation.
Sure. So start with the easy stuff. Our budget is about 50 million. We're almost entirely dependent on donor dollars for that. We don't receive government funding for operations. And my fundraising team is 44. We've got, and what we do as an organization, so Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in BC, is we provide animal protection. So when an animal is vulnerable in the community, and that can range from everything from, and our focus is increasingly on keeping families together. And so our focus is increasingly on what supports do you need to keep your beloved animal.
Mm.
And so whether that's food bank or an emergency boarding because you've lost your pet friendly housing, or you have to go into the hospital, or you're fleeing domestic violence, those supports, sometimes, although it's increasingly hard with veterinary crisis of doing veterinary supports. And then right at the most vulnerable end, that may look like an investigation if there's been animal abuse, that may look like bringing an animal into our care in the shelters. And so there's that sort of whole stream of looking after vulnerable animals and their humans. And then there's that sort of social change piece. So we offer humane education to build up empathy in kids through interactions with animals. We advocate for changes in legislation to make a stronger safety net for animals.
Thank you for backtracking there with me. You mentioned 44 staff. So does primarily the fundraising team report into you, or do you have other staff as well?
No, so it's primarily the fundraising team. I have two sort of outliers that are new this year is our animal helpline also reports into me. So the manager of the animal helpline reports in. And we just, and the animal helpline started to take call, it started We started to take calls of reported cruelty, and it sort of has evolved into more wildlife in distress, when people need emergency boarding, when we're in fire or flood situations and they're asking for assistance. And there's just started to be a huge overlap in commonalities between them and our Generosity Services Department, who are the front line for conversations with donors.
You call them Generosity Services?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So thank you for all of that. And that also provides us context for my next question, Shoni, which is, what you do really pulls on the heartstrings of everybody every day. There's nothing more than an animal in distress. I don't know what it is about us humans, maybe because they can't help themselves. I don't know what it is, but it's an emotional, it's emotional work to work in that space. So let's acknowledge that. And that sets us up so nicely for my next question. How do you or do you take care of the mental and physical well-being of your staff?
And I'm going to preface this with saying that I feel like I could do a lot more. The great thing is that this is more of a conversation in the workplace now. And so I think if people aren't feeling like there's still more to do, then maybe just sit and look at that for a while. Cause I think we're all in a place of recognizing we need to do a lot more. I think the first part ties to, what we've been discussing right now of giving people feelings of autonomy and competence in their work and feeding those psychological needs. The other of those three core psychological needs is connection. And we've worked really consciously, especially through the pandemic, at building that up. Right away went into very regular in those first couple of weeks. Gosh, it was like very, very regular meetings of the whole department to bring us together and managers bringing their teams together, always building some sort of social or just getting to know each other into that. So we're strengthening those personal connections. Mm-hmm. That looks like we did virtual escape rooms and virtual quiz shows and virtual Jeopardy and a whole pile of stuff to try and maintain those personal connections of hold on to the fact that we really like working with each other, that we're having fun together. So that having people feel that they have connections, the last couple of years has been a lot about being very flexible about people's personal situations of, again, we have a roadmap and it defines where we need to get to. If how you get there needs to take a little detour, if how you get there takes a, looks different, then that's okay. And, the most tangible of that is trying to be really flexible with staff with young children, like scheduling social things so they're within work hours so that they're not feeling excluded from the team or having to make a choice around childcare. Being really supportive, having gone through a lot of stress earlier in my career around mat leaves, being very trying to be very supportive about mat leaves and staying connected with people and making sure they know what's going on and are feeling connected and feeling supported coming back could look different, being very open about having those conversations of, does it need to look different for a while? Are you, is your work day early morning and later in the evening because that's what works to you? I'm not going to be, say, well, the rigid, it's got to be between 9 to 5 because it's not healthy working after hours, if actually holding to that causes you more stress than being flexible and recognizing you actually need to do 3 hours in the evening so you can go pick up your kids from school and take some time off and then come back to it.
I love that. And you were able to come back to your core anchor of keeping focused on the ultimate goal. And then with that goal in mind, we're all there to get to the same goal. There's room for flexibility around your workplace structure. So even the willingness, and I love that you acknowledged, maybe I could think more about this or talk to the staff more. I love that you did that because, of course, we are in a new We are working in a new environment, aren't we? We are forging new cultures in this post-pandemic world where we're reevaluating our lifestyles and our careers. And so employers who are flexible around that, or at least willing to say, hey, let's take a look at this and see if we could do better, that will set your organization up for greater success in the future, I think.
Yeah. And there's a couple of big challenges to that. The pandemic really blurred the lines between work and home. And so it's like people are working longer hours and, you know, and because, you know, I never had that concern of like, oh, once people leave the office, how do we know that they're really doing the work? And my team just worked so hard that, I mean, always, and that first 6 months was really like, we don't know how long we're going to be able to fundraise for. We need to do everything. Mm. And we'd come off of end of year giving and we had a short break to do like consolidated tax receipting. That was the rest that year. And then, you know, and everyone in the field, you know, and in any sector, then it was straight into pandemic. And then end of year giving again. Then the following year, we had bad fire season, bad flood season in BC. Mm. Like, we've just been operating at high performance for a really long time, and there hasn't been a lot of times to take a breath, and that's dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous because I think fundraisers are a bit adrenaline junkies, and they get into this like, it's perfect, we're doing great, we're, you know, we're raising the bar, and they keep doing that. And so it's hard for me, and then hard for me to remind everyone else, like, what's the minimum viable here? Sometimes we have to scale back sometimes and not be pushing like full throttle all the time, because that's not healthy for us. We've been, and I think even 2022 was exhausting because people were trying to pretend like things were normal again, and they'd just come through this huge collective trauma and they were exhausted. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't refilled our tanks.
We haven't. So I have two questions that come to mind, because I can see the feeling and the compassion in your, I can hear it in your voice. I can see it in your face. If you could wave a magic wand, what would you change for the way your staff is working? Or maybe you don't need to wave a magic wand. Maybe you're already scaling back your goals for next year. I don't know. But what are you doing?
I mean, I think like the answer isn't more staff, more resources, because we always just, we add those. I mean, those are great and they help us grow, but we always add those at the point where we're past capacity, but we justify them by saying we're going to do new things as well. And you know, that doesn't, it's like building a 16 lane highway. It doesn't reduce traffic. Studies have shown over time, you know, it's just more people come. Mm-hmm. And so we just find more stuff to busy ourselves with. I'd like to, so I don't, there's no easy answers, but this is something that I've been mulling over for a while and I can't figure out how to execute it, is I want to give space for deep thought. Mm-hmm. Like I want people to have the, like even if you could like once a quarter, just everyone has like 2 days that's like, they're sitting with their work, but they're shut off from everyone else. And they just get to think about how to order things and prioritize things and how to let things go. And how to invest the time up front in order to make it more efficient and effective to build capacity. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it just, so often people are like, if I just had a couple of days, I would rework how this report runs. And, you know, so it would take me 10 minutes rather than 2 days every month, or, you know, stuff like that. And that's it's clearly not dealing with some very large issues and needs around mental health, but I feel like people just need a little space. I mean, I can push that people take their vacations. I can push back when I see people working out of hours, unless that's what works best for them to be healthy. Mm-hmm. I can be very conscious myself about not sending emails after hours and creating expectations that people respond, or putting in reasonable timelines, not saying everything is urgent. And yet even, you know, there's a lot of support needed in getting that, in defining those lines and giving people space for their time off to be truly time off and for us to get out of their head. But there also needs to be, I think, space in work to just be able to be thoughtful and very slowed down about what you're planning.
I love that. I love that, that providing staff, providing your whole team, including yourself, for space for deep thought. And that's different than giving them an extra day off, isn't it? Because you and I both know that when you have a day off, you're racing around doing groceries or packing up to go camping or hurrying up to go and have fun or something. You're not able to really take that space for reflection and thinking, even if you don't know what it is you're supposed to be thinking about right in that moment, right?
Yeah. It's those shower thoughts. You know, I don't know about you. I have shower thoughts where I'm like, oh, I just made this connection. I've been mulling this over for ages. Mm-hmm. And clearly my subconscious brain was working on it, but I just made this great connection.
Yeah. Or they can come up in the middle of the night. So you wake up for an hour and you write in your journal. But it used to drive me nuts if that would happen when I was commuting to Toronto, to 2-hour commute, and I had to get up at 4:30, 5 o'clock to get on the train.
Yeah.
You know, but my deep thinking happened at 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. So that rigidity around these work structures no longer works. But there, I recorded another episode of a podcast with another guy named Brandon from Vancouver. And he has no meeting days, like no meetings a couple of times a week. And they're pretty rigorous around that. And he's got a 4-day work week.
Yeah.
Now, I can see how that would be a challenge with 45 staff and a $50 million organization. But in his podcast, which I'm not sure exactly the sequence of these things being published, but in his podcast, he's like challenging larger organizations to implement some of these practices.
So. Yeah. And we've organizationally, we've talked to our department does run on a 9-day fortnight, and that second Friday or the second Monday off for people is magic, because that's your running around shopping, doctor's appointments, errand day. And then you free up that space on the weekend for like truly recharging yourself.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, and I know we've discussed what, you know, what the implications of a 4-day week would look like. And one of the things if we're really lucky, we all fall into the area that gets us excited and we love doing. And I, you know, when I say to our head of people services, I couldn't do what you do. And she's like, I couldn't do what you do. So it's great. We're in the right place. But I just look at the load those teams have taken on in the last 3-4 years, like increased concerns about mental health, figuring out pandemic safety protocols, figuring out remote work, doing this in a way that protects our staff's safety, that keeps the organization moving forward. We've had huge amount of work we've been that I think everyone's doing in equity, diversity, and reconciliation, or a lot of people are doing. Mm-hmm. So there's just been all this, like all these big topics for HR, people services departments, and there's the pace of change for them is so huge. I really respect that our leader in people services is very good at saying when the rest of us around the table say, what about this?
Right.
Say, tell me more about this. And then, okay, and what should come off our plate?
Yes.
And it's a very good formula. And then it usually brings us to the point of like, yep, you're right. You've ordered these as they have to be ordered, from sort of like most risk to our well-being and we're working through them. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of work to be done in that area to structure the workplace, restructure the workplace to help us recover from the pandemic and build forward in a really sort of healthy, sustainable way.
You know what I feel? The image that came to mind for me was a lava lamp. Remember lava lamps? They're a lamp for us younger folks who there's a lot of retro stuff out there now, but and the oil sort of warms up and then it just slowly creeps up to the top. And I wonder if this idea of restructuring our workplaces and prioritizing boundaries for our staff in terms of what they're capable of and creating that space for them. I feel like as you're talking about it, it's just like this lava lamp floating up, and you know it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's going to have to be dealt with in a very concrete way soon, because we are still raw from all of the things that have been going on in our world, aren't we?
Yeah.
So
at least now we're talking about it, because I feel like it was there before, and there was a lot of sort of intergenerational snarking about different work modes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of the things that people were being really snarky about, not looking at you avocado toast memes, but like, turns out to be like, yeah, this is the basis of what we're talking about, of like a really healthy workplace.
Yeah.
So, you know, the more we can maybe not fall into that generational snarking trap again and say like, okay, what's healthy and good that's coming out of these like things that are bubbling up?
Mm. So is that what gives you hope? What gives you hope for the future of our sector?
Well, I mean, I think, I had cause to sort of sit down and read something on fundraising ethics the other day. And it was a very sort of, it was the, you know, traditional fundraising ethics. And I'm like, that was really focused on like, they're very transactional as like our workers' money movers. And I just started thinking, okay, what's missing from this? And what's bubbling up, and you know, and our discussions around community-centric fundraising are bringing like rights balancing into fundraising, and saying, it's important that the donor's treated well. It's important that the staff are treated well. It's important that the clients of our services are treated well. And we balance all of those things out with our collective responsibility to all of our well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, that work, the discussions around community-centric fundraising, more discussions around fundraisers' bills of rights and right to be safe and heard and well-being. Mm-hmm. Like all of this stuff is really exciting, that it feels like our profession has expanded its scope beyond the moving money to stuff that's really advancing the social goods sector.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes,
oh, I got goosebumpy when you explain that. Like, you're right. All this stuff, it can be really deeply uncomfortable for a lot of people, for everybody at certain points, but it's so good, isn't it? Yeah.
It's really good. And I think like 20, 25 years ago, the conversation around fundraising, like, I remember the workplace where I was told as a fundraiser, you can't come to the annual planning meetings for the organization, because if the money's in the room, it's the tail wagging the dog.
Right.
And like, that was really the reality of like, we know we begrudgingly need the money, but it's sort of dirty. It's sort of the snake oil salesman that you're tricking people into donating. And it just really feels like fundraising is becoming organizationally relevant in a way that goes beyond money, because there's a growing recognition that our job connecting people and talking about values and consciousness raising is really actually intrinsically tied to the mission. It's not just what makes the mission possible. And I love that expanding role of the magic that fundraisers can do.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that That's church right there for me. Like, it's like, oh yes, that's why we do all this and push our boundaries and have these conversations. So if we were to stop this conversation right now, is there anything left unsaid?
Oh boy. I think it's, you know, it's fundraising, like fundraising and our work, I think is really iterative. And I think as long as we is both a trap and a blessing that fundraisers are frequently the people to say, how can I help? And so we sort of ask that question. And I think like if we can use that iterative approach to, you know, everything from how we fine tune our fundraising practices to how we help build up organizational strength and resilience beyond money to how we take care of ourselves, and each other. It feels like there's a huge amount of work ahead, and I feel like probably everyone looks ahead and says there's a huge amount of work ahead. Like, no matter what time you've been in history, there's always a huge amount of work ahead because you're always just conscious of the new things. But I feel like now is more important than ever to have long-term roadmaps and have a vision of where we want to go, but recognize it's going to take iterative change. And in some cases, it just really needs to take like huge, big change right now for, you know, for justice. And some of those things are long and slow. And some of them I really, you know, are way past time and we just need to put everything we can into it. So I'm contradicting myself there, but I think having a sort of sense of what based on our values needs to be fast and slow for us.
Yeah. And it's not one or the other. It's both.
Yeah.
It's both. And we just have to keep chipping away at it, don't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, and being a white settler, being comfortable with getting pushed back on like, on this, we just can't chip away because we've been chipping away for hundreds of years and that's not working. Like we need some revolution on this.
Oh,
and,
great point.
You know, and it's, and there's some uncomfortable stuff ahead, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's time. It's time. Yeah. Thank you for coming and joining us in the hub. I'm so grateful for you to bring your whole self in and share all of these bits of wisdom, Shoni. I really appreciate you, and I'm so glad to know you.
Thank you. I thank you so much. It was such a treat to meet you. And get to know you and to give me the space to talk about what's important to me and how I do it, because I love what I do. And it's, I find, and one of the reasons I present at conferences is it's very healthy for me to articulate why I do things. That's how I build up my approach. So it's been a great opportunity. Thank you.
Right? Isn't she great? Thanks for sticking around. I have three asks for you. One, share this episode with your team and then book a meeting and have a conversation about how you can implement some of these practices in your organization. Building a loyal team will save you money. And remember, if you have more examples of charities that you think we should spotlight next season, we are actively curating season 5 right now. So check out the show notes for how to connect with us. And finally, thank you for making this a priority in your day. We are so glad you are part of this community and would be so grateful if you would take a second right now and just give a, you know, tap the stars, rate this podcast, share it with some friends so that we can keep widening the circle. Thank you so much. See you next time.